March 28, 1996. I want to start, as you look back after 10 years, what kinds of things do you see as the significant things about NREACTOR that things we should remember?
NREACTOR always impressed me in that it tried to do many things. It was the first and only U.S. production and power reactor. And that, I think, was mainly due to a lot of effort by local Tri-Cityans, people like Glenn Lee and Sam Volkentest, who, in their effort to attract the Atomic Energy Commission to put the reactor here, wanted to sell it for more than just plutonium, but also for power. And so it was a real engineering feat. But because it was so complicated, it also had lots of little gremlins running around causing problems in terms of its operability. And then as the production requirements went down, it was very fortunate that it was a power producer because it was able to go into a longer operating mode, make fuel-grade plutonium, and still provide power. So I think it was a real pioneer in that sense. And it's appropriate also that it was in the Northwest because it was a pioneer. But I think also, though, you look back and when Chernobyl occurred, that's probably the single most riveting event in my time here at Hanford was the after Chernobyl, when everyone had such serious concerns about the Chernobyl reactor, what its environmental impact would be for Europe and for the world. They really couldn't get to that reactor. The only thing they could get to was Hanford, and in the NREACTOR, we had people here in droves.
Well, it came out pretty well in the reviews.
Well, it did. In terms of comparing it to Chernobyl, and in terms of what happened at Chernobyl and whether it could happen here, I think conclusively we showed that, because of the key design feature of a negative void coefficient, which is the technical term, what happened at Chernobyl specifically couldn't happen here. But it led to oversight and review of DOE facilities that hadn't occurred before. And I think has culminated now in the review that the department had looking at independent oversight, either by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board, or someone else. So in its own unique way, NREACTOR was again a first of a kind and a trendsetter because it started that independent oversight.
It is a good example of kind of our ability to balance advanced technology with proven technology, and then they were able to build it on the schedule and make it operate safely for a long time. And it seems that today we have trouble incorporating new technology, not willing to take potential risks. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on what it takes to incorporate new technology with dealing or in general in society.
Well, it always takes a balance. You want to use the best technology available, and new technology can reduce cost and can reduce exposure and all. But there's always a certain amount of risk to it, and that balancing of risk is something that I think perhaps in the past we may have been able to do a little bit better because we weren't always faced with an endless list of what ifs that almost can paralyze you. Leaders have to step up and say, okay, I understand, yes, there is a risk, nothing is risk-free, but I have judged, based upon the best analysis, that this is an acceptable risk and we'll move forward. If you allow yourself to become paralyzed in the decision-making process, you don't make any progress.
Which kind of ties into this question of your role in opening up the site and NREACTOR to the public, and NREACTOR kind of was right in that same time frame, more so with the release of documents, I suppose, but then NREACTOR's trouble that it happened right after. And so then you have that balance again of listening to the different stakeholder factions and trying to make your decision and be sensitive or meaningful and involved in. Do you have any thoughts on where the whole stakeholder involvement trend is going?
I think it's fantastic. And, you know, I I'm very lucky and fortunate. People give me some credit for opening up the site, but I think it was, you know, it was a no-brainer in that it's the right thing to do. It's the democratic process requires people to be involved in the decision-making process. Unfortunately, back in the 70s and 80s, people didn't have the facts and the data to be involved in the decision-making process. People didn't have any idea of what was going on at Hanford, so it didn't take a genius to realize you need to provide the people with more information, that a lot of what was going on at the site no longer needed to be classified, and just open the process up. And I think what's going on today, that, you know, Secretary O'Leary is famous for it, is really the only way you're going to get sensible decisions, is by making people aware of all the facts, all the data, so that they can see there's no simple solution. There's no risk-free solution. If you say, don't do this, then you're going to have to live with something else for a longer period of time. So I'm strongly in favor of it, but it still boils down to government officials having to make a decision, because you have 60% in favor and 40% against, and it takes some hard decisions. And those decisions can be made, and they are being made, but it does require someone to step up to the plate and take a swing on that.
I get the impression from earlier years that the oversight at that time, AEC, over the contractors maybe was less. Or at least we've kind of gone through this wave of we need more oversight, we need less oversight. And some being with a contractor, sometimes we think that we get too much oversight. Have you figured out, since you've been on both sides of the fence, what the proper oversight is of contractors?
Well, to have proper oversight, you have to have sufficient and qualified people on both sides to do the job. The government never can and never will have all of the best and the brightest scientists go out and operate the facilities, do all the designs. But they do need to have enough people to do the oversight, to look at a design, to look at a plan, and to ask good questions, challenge those people, but then not get down to micromanage. And I'm real pleased with the fact that there are more DOE people here now today than there were when I was here, because we were always behind the curve in terms of having enough people to really be out on the site when we needed to be out on the site, or to be reviewing the plans and the programs. The bulk of the people were necessary for doing a lot of the administrative work and budget work, which is essential and does require government people. But on the other hand, in terms of asking the technical questions about, okay, what is in that waste tank? What is in the solution? Why is that hydrogen being formed? We were short-staffed in those days. And I give a lot of credit to the people who were here at that time, because they had to do an awful lot of work and put in long hours to get the job done. But getting back to your question, it requires a balance, and it requires qualified people on both sides. And if you try to do it with either too many or too few, you're not going to have the proper balance. The reason I say too many is if you've got too many people looking over your shoulder, they can come up with an endless list of questions, and the contractor never gets the job done. You have too few, there's no counterbalance, no one's asking questions, and maybe the right priorities aren't addressed. So I guess I gave you a roundabout answer, but it's not a simple question to have to deal with.
Have you read Atomic Harvest?
I've seen part of it.
Seen part of it, yeah. Do you think parts you saw were fair?
Well, the parts that I read where he attributed motives, I thought were way off base. And I can only talk specifically to those things that deal with me or my family and conversations that took place. There are ulterior motives that were put into that book that claim we were trying to do certain things, which I know full well and good that those weren't the motives. The motives were to try to to get things in a safe mode and operate efficiently. And we weren't trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. It makes good reading, perhaps. It makes sensational reading, but it's not very accurate in that regard.
What kinds of things do you think we can learn from looking back at Henry Acker's experience that might help us today in these various areas we've been talking about?
A couple of things about Henry Acker come to mind. One is that it's very, very true when the critics say that the reactor was neglected in the 70s, it was. It wasn't producing material really for the weapons program, it was for fuel grade, and the type of upgrades and improvements and continual attention to safe operation, it just didn't have the level of support for that it needed. In the it started in President Carter's term, but then when President Reagan came in, money was put into the reactor to upgrade it, to improve its safety features and operating efficiency, and they were very, very successful. Consequently, when Chernobyl occurred, the reactor was able to withstand scrutiny and come out very, very well. If that had happened before those upgrades, we would have been in serious difficulty because it wasn't that well along. But the N reactor, I think, gave me a real example, and I'll give you a vivid image of the importance of openness in making the public part of the process. After Chernobyl occurred, about 2 days after it, the entire lobby of the federal building was filled with every television network, wire service, CNN, they were all down clamoring to do a story on N reactor. And I'm on the phone to Washington where I said, look, we've got to show these people the reactor. We've got to talk to them about it. And they say, don't talk to them. Don't say anything. And I said, that's not an option. They're interviewing each other. They're going out. They're interviewing people in the street. A story is going to be written. It can either be based on fact or it can be based on fiction. But we've got to do that. And they did agree. We went out, got a bus, took all these reporters out to the N reactor. And they had an image, a visual image in their mind. I'm sure it was like a Quonset hut or a little tin building with a reactor boiling away inside. And yet when we took them out there and we actually were able to open a door to the confinement, they could see the 3 to 4 foot thick concrete walls. They came away and wrote much, much different stories than they went out there with. They said, yeah, there's a similar reactor, but boy, this is a substantial building. It wasn't perfect, but it showed the value of being open, showing people what you've got, and involving them. And N reactor, if nothing else, opened the door on DOE facilities and DOE operations that will never be shut again. And I think that's a real contribution to this.
Well, that issue of, do you have to run?
No. I've got 12:15, I've got to be
able to start. They talked about letting that go in the 70s, because, you know, I think people assume that probably would be shut down and why put money into keeping facilities. That's a question schools face and everybody faces on maintenance.
Yeah.
I guess it's just the cost of doing business for high tech.
And really the maintenance and the problems in those days were really with its operability. You know, it would be shut down more often than perhaps it needed to be. The safety systems continued to work, but they weren't upgraded, or improvements as they were identified weren't really made. And, that's not any one particular person's blame or organization's blame. Congress has to approve the funds. Where was the oversight? Where was the push to get that? A lot of people share in that. But ultimately, it was recognized that when the reactor was going to be making material that was deemed necessary for national security, national defense, the money was there and it was able to be upgraded. And those upgrades served the well. I remember the thing that always was a great concern after Chernobyl was the reactor was operating when Chernobyl occurred. And the fear was, okay, if for any reason for an unplanned reason, it went down. It may never come back up again. And prior to that, we had been having some difficulties it's called fuel failures. Now, that sounds like a terrible thing. It is in terms of operational efficiency, but not in terms of safety. The reactor is designed to cope with it very, very easily. But we were very, very concerned that maybe a reoccurrence of a fuel failure would cause the reactor to go down at an unplanned time, and we knew that would be very difficult. And the reactor performed flawlessly. We didn't have any fuel failures. It went through and operated like clockwork until the decision was made. We really no longer need the product. And once you don't, if you didn't need the plutonium, and the power was never the justification for the reactor, it was a byproduct, it was never the justification. When you didn't need the plutonium, it was time to shut the reactor down. And that was probably one of the most difficult days and announcements I had to make. So we went out, Bill Jacoby of Westinghouse Hanford Company and myself went out. I had gotten an agreement from Washington that before it was announced back there, that they'd give us 2 hours advance notice so the workers could hear it first and not hear it on the radio, not hear it on the news, not hear it by anyone gloating that they had shut the reactor down. And we did go out there, and I remember they had a truck set out. We got up on the flatbed and told the workers of the decision. But they took it as well as could be expected, and that was a very difficult task.
I had just moved here, and about a month later, BWIP shut down, and reactor shut down.
Yeah, we had a school levy going on at the same time, and that was one of the only few school levies, at least in those days, that had gone down. Because it was right after, I think, a senator had announced that it was going to shut down. It was before the formal announcement. And the levy went down to the beat, but we put it back up a couple months later, and it passed, and the schools were supported.
One of the distinguishing characteristics of NREACT was this partnership with the supply system.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that early 60s was right about when the diversification kind of movement for Hanford really got going. Do you have much thoughts in the way of this partnership with the government and private industry and how that's developing?
Oh, I think it's a great way to go. It's the balance. There are some things that are a government responsibility, and because the risks are too great or are not definable that the government needs to do. But there are other things the private industry does very well. And I think Hanford's always been very interested and in the forefront of trying to diversify, to make this community less dependent on the federal government. And that's a necessary thing, because as we can all see, as the site gets cleaned up, there are going to be less federal jobs here, or federal money coming here, and that's going to require other activities. I happen to feel it was a great place to live, to raise a family, and I wish the community well in attracting other business here.
Ideas. Do you have any other things you think we should?
I guess not. I guess that pretty well covers it. Tell me a little bit about your formal ceremonies on Saturday.
Well, Saturday we're going to, Gwen's going to just get up and kind of talk about Crest, that's the new name here, and where they're going. I'm going to then talk about why we're doing this project. One, we're doing this project to kind of comply with the National Historic Preservation Act, because Hanford is an important historic site. NREACT is an important part of Hanford's site. And so before they can kind of demolish, the facility, take it all down, there's some requirements to kind of document the history and preserve some records and things like that, so that, the story is told or can be told. So I'll talk about what that is, and I'm trying to bring in that it isn't just history for history's sake, but that we can learn some things, or it's useful to remember some of these things like you've been talking about. And then Sam was going to get up and talk about getting Kennedy here,
yeah.
And we'll show that film, because it's a great speech. probably haven't seen it.
I haven't. No.
It's a really good speech. President Dave. And we have John Wagner's going to talk after that on kind of the different themes or sort of at Hanford and how they're reflected at and react as an environmental movement. It was designed that way to stop putting the contaminants in the river.
Yeah.
And the partnership theme with the supply system, and the new technology, and balancing the technology, and getting it done. And they did design a new kind of reactor, and made the schedule and cost constraints, and operated safely.
Yeah,
whole public involvement. And then our congressman, Doc Hastings, was one of the have a driver on the less federal expenditure and need to privatize and this kind of thing. So we're hoping that a lot of the former workers will come in and we'll kind of get the word out of this effort. And we're trying to bring in more of what people remember, as well as the documents. But you go through the documents and
they can be kind of dry.
You can't trust them anymore, really, then. Yeah. Not the trust, but I mean that they don't report everything.
Purpose.
So to balance the two, it's a lot more interesting to talk to you.
Has the newspaper run anything about
that? Oh, yeah, they've been real good. They had a front page story.
I guess it was Jim Jesternik's father who was in the reviewing staff. I think that's the case. I'm trying to remember because I remember someone always used to point out because a picture of Kennedy and it was up on the wall in the manager's office and they'd always come.
When did you first go?
I came here in 84. From 84 to 90. So I've been away as long as I've been. As long as I was here. It's hard to believe. It's 6 years ago.
We had a couple of years before it heated up.
Yeah. 86 was. God, it started. I look back once, and every month it seemed like, at least in the first half of the year, there was a major event that had an impact on Hanford. And interestingly enough, the first one was in January when the Challenger exploded. And I remember Mike Talbot running in and saying, turn on the television, there's the Challenger just blew up. And the impact was, here was something that people had always said, and say, it's going to work, technology, and all of a sudden, boom, it didn't. And it raised questions. And then in February, we started the whole process from the Defense Waste Environmental Impact Statement, public involvement in it. April was Chernobyl. There were just a whole host of things that... February is when we released the 19,000 pages of documents.
Yeah.
That's right. And then it was in March that we started the public involvement process on the Defense Waste Environmental Impact Statement. April was Chernobyl. May. That summer was the sign incidents. You remember where some people claimed that signs were taken down when Governor Gardner first came over here. Then there were whistleblower issues that summer. It was a challenging year. And later that year is when the contract consolidation, the winners were announced. You know, the Western House won. So 1986 was a heck of a year.
Well, one of the things we're trying to do is look at this as a lot of times in the history, either we're talking about all the great stuff, or there's a conspiracy and looking for the real story. And so now we're trying to just say, this is what we did. Certainly,
you'd be the judge.
We never did everything right. No one ever does. Yeah. And so some things we were right on, and some things maybe the requirements weren't as great as they should have been. But so what do we get out of it? Let's learn from all that. And I think what we need to learn is realize that we've kind of come to this risk averse kind of thing. And people have this fantasy, this is my kind of theory, I guess, that that their conception, their perception of new technology is a panacea that is all upside.
What we're doing was new technology. It was the big answer. And then, you know, you can't just say, well, I don't want that, bring me another solution. Yeah. There are only so many solutions around.
So that maybe through exhibits like this or something, people can understand that there's upside and risk that take along with it. And it's not always going to work out, but you got to get going. Like you said, with leadership, and you've got to make a decision.
One of the early mottos, we had a management retreat here, we came back with the motto, ready, fire, aim. And it was just to try to avoid this problem of never making, doing anything and always fiddling around. That's probably not a good motto, but it did sort of say, we want it to be action-oriented. You want it to try to get something done. Don't just sit around. Make something happen.
One of the biggest sticky points on all this these days is the diverging opinion on radionuclides in the environment. You know, some people, one is too many, and the others, if it goes in the rivers, diluted, and there is no real health impact. Do you have any thoughts on how we resolve that issue, or...
Again, I still think it's a matter of education, a matter of realizing that everything has some level of contamination, some risk, and not to let people believe falsely that there's some risk-free approach that can be taken, and to try to remove the radioactive aspect has a terrible taboo associated with it. And, you know, that's understandable when you think about how people have learned about it and what even some of the Hanford workers say. You know, they try to impress people with how, you know, they deal with this. And that's a mistake. You've got to recognize it's a hazardous material and it needs to be dealt with safely and with respect and properly handled. But people have to understand that when you do that, those risks are minimal and are less than many other things that we commonly accept. And if we're ever going to solve these problems, we've got to take those small, minimal risks to get the job done. So it's education again.
You think nuclear technology is here to stay?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it may not be in power generation. Hopefully we won't need it for weapons. But in terms of medicine, in terms of industry, it's phenomenal. We couldn't the cures and the medical techniques and treatments that take place utilizing nuclear techniques right now are phenomenal. And I think if you ever try to take them away from the public, there'd be an outcry. Maybe they don't recognize it. Maybe it's just as well that they don't recognize it. But on the other hand, nuclear technology is very, very much a part of everything we do today, and it's not going to change.
Well,
okay.
There's Gwen. Why don't I give you a chance to say
hi, Gwen.
How are you?